when the cultural message is being delivered, then the field teams that are out there recruiting are going to recruit not for staffing, but for service, sales and service. And the
that's experience. A great way to frame it.
Yeah.
And right now, and for the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years, I've seen this erode over time, that it's become more about staffing than it has been about service or any customer experience. And I have to be quite honest with all of you. When I hear anyone who talks about experience, creating an experience, if you're not about to hire a number of talented people who are customer oriented and happy to serve, you haven't got a hope in hell in making that experience come to life. You just don't. And you're wasting time and effort.
And they have to be brand loyalists. I mean, that's the other key too. Like, if you got staff on the floor and they're not connected to your brand, like, how are they going to sell your brand? So whether that's, you know, they're given the apparel to wear, to try, that they've experienced it themselves, that they can build that sense of community with the people that are coming in. I think, you know, again, a lot of like athleisure brands do that. Like, their staff are wearing the product. They're really used to it. I use Aritzia as a great example. Now, they've got stores down here, but they really connect with the consumer when you walk in the door. They show you what's new. You get in the fitting room. They're really helping you. I mean, there's been many times when I've gone in there and I'd say, you know, I'd never get something, and they opened me up to thinking about something I wouldn't have thought of before. So, but it's, you know, again, there's they're brand loyalists. They want to be a part of the brand. They want to share the brand with you and share what they like about it. And they want to help you find something really great so that you can become a brand fan.
Sorry, Christine, could I just return to George's point about the customer experience? And I think there's a much wider point here. I feel it in Canada. We love concepts, omni-channel, you know, this kind of stuff, customer experience, a customer journey, store of future. It's all about talking about something rather than doing something. We can mystify ourselves by talking a lot amongst ourselves about whatever it might be, whatever this week's fad is. I just wonder how much energy is poured into these great concepts, maybe in the glossy brochure, or heard recently on the radio, or seen in the commentary, or a consultant they bumped into in a drinking hole. They seem to get obsessed with the thought of this great, you know, competitive advantage that we're going to get if we only can find a way of implementing. Oh, don't worry about implementation, just talk about it, it's fine, we're delivering curbside.
We're by the system, Gary. If we bought the system, then we can check the box, right? It's a product.
There's a big difference between the theory of creating service and customer experience versus actually delivering it, to Gary's point, right? I mean, look, we as executives, even as a junior and mid executive, we used to laugh at anybody that worked in the office and would try and come out with a strategy on customer experience or service, and they haven't spent 1 hour in a store. I mean, that is a joke. You want to understand as an organization how to change what's happening in the stores, get out of your desk, send the marketing and merchandising team down to the stores, not for days, weeks.
Yeah.
Working.
Right. And, there's a lot of great brands that do that.
And go to the best of the best. Go visit those.
As retailers entered the lockdown in March 2020, a small, diverse group of Canadian thought leaders gathered to virtually speculate, collaborate, and share their insights on the waves of disruption facing retailers. The Business of Retail podcast emerged as an unflinching strategic alternative to the conventional discourse, revealing challenges in the headlines and exploring new unconventional paths for all facets of the retail industry. Now, here's the panel.
Welcome to the Business of Retail podcast. I'm Craig Patterson. We're joined here today with our regular panelists, and I'll read them in no particular order. We've got David Ian Gray, Christine Cowan, George Menakakis, and Gary Newbury. Welcome, everyone. Just a reminder to everyone here to subscribe to this podcast. You can find us on your favorite podcast provider. We're also on YouTube, and you can also find us on thebusinessofretail.ca, which is our website. So getting back to this again. Now, the topic today is quite a hot topic. We're going to be talking about customer service and selling and the lost art of retail. We're going to talk a little bit about what some retailers are doing or not doing in the case, and we'll be naming a few names. We'll also talk a little bit about Canada versus the United States, how retail employees are viewed, say, by the public, and also retail as a career generally and how that's viewed here in Canada versus elsewhere. So how should we get started here in terms of the conversation?
I want to hear from Christine. She's in the States.
Are things really better down there, Christine? Because certainly you're from Canada, but you're now living in Portland, Oregon. Would you say you're getting a better customer service experience when you go into stores there versus up in colder Canada?
Or is it a myth, Christine? Is this a myth that's just so hurtful for all the service providers in Canada that are clock watching?
This is a tough one because you're putting me in a spot where, being a loyal, proud Canadian and now living in the US, I'm going to have to kind of play both hats here. But I think, you know, definitely recently, with now the fact that we're more open, I think, than you are in Ontario and maybe a little bit more than BC, and we're getting back out to retail, we definitely saw some pretty intense customer service during COVID. Obviously, people trying to manage people coming in store, helping people, navigating long lineups, et cetera. Now that's sort of backing off a bit, but I do think there's, you know, from an independent perspective, you have incredible independent retailers here that have great customer service, are very welcoming. They tell you their stories. They talk about the product in store. They really want to have you experience things. And there's a store called Made Here PDX that carries all Made in Oregon product. And every time I go in there, there's something new. It's really interesting. The staff will have a conversation with you. They talk about the product. They give you the history. It's really a journey. It's not really like a hard sell, but you go in there and you just come out of there going, wow, I really learned something about these products and these brands. And it's just, it's always really interesting and exciting. And then on the other side, you know, you have like the Targets of the world where you go in and you definitely get your customer service there. They've got self-serve kiosks. As you're checking out, you know, they're really diligent and thorough. So you're never really feeling like you're not seeing someone in their red shirt on the floor. Contrast that with some of the stores in Canada that I've been into, and you definitely get challenged. You walk in the store, you are struggling to find something. You don't maybe hear the help, get the help that you want. And you don't really get the storytell. I think just trying to be so lean, you kind of miss out on that. And I feel like the customer connection is really missing. And, you know, I, back in the day, worked at the Gap, and it was like the McDonald's of retail. And we were really trained well, and you'd greet the customer when they came in, and you talk about what was in the store, and you'd have the add-on sale of socks or whatever it was. But you really like followed that customer and made sure that, you know, they'd come in and then you'd pass them off to someone in the back and they'd help them with the jeans or whatever. But I think you kind of miss that these days. And I don't know if it's just retailers are struggling, and so they're trying to just get somebody on the floor, or that they're not giving great training to staff to be able to understand like the art of selling, because there is an art. It's a relationship. It's a conversation. And I think it's important that brands have people that are great ambassadors. So, you know, I always reference Lulu. That's a great store where you come in and they're really great about the product, and you understand the reasoning behind the product. And even if you don't, there's a way to kind of self-discover it. So I think retailers like that are doing really well. The ones that aren't are, you know, often the big box. You go in there, we talked about this before, you can't find help. It's just really frustrating. But I think the ones that are going to cut through are the ones that build that sense of community and connection with people. And a lot of the direct-to-consumer brands right now are doing that. And that community and the two-way conversation, I think people want that. They want that connectivity, and they want to know that they're understood and heard. And if they've had a bad experience, that they're addressing it and they're not just sort of pushing it to the side. So
I think let's come back to the direct-to-consumer one, because I think that's fresh right now. We're getting to experience that a lot for the first time, maybe for many of us, right, compared to 20 years ago. But I'm not convinced they're good at exception handling. But I think we should come back to that, because I think you made the point, Christine, that there's endemically a difference between the US and Canada. And we've heard that for forever. And I don't think it's a COVID thing. I feel it too. I don't think it's just a myth. That's not a myth. That's true. But I'm curious why that is. If we see what service and selling can be, then why is it so hard to emulate that? And I thought maybe George, maybe you could help us a little bit, because as a CEO, is there something different in the financial structures, the economic models of operating in the US and Canada? I know Asia, where you can have so many employees to serve you, part of that is low labor costs. But is there a cause and effect here somewhere that we don't talk about?
Well, you know what? Every retailer, whether it's anywhere in the world, they all have productivity schedules, right? They schedule according to their revenue when it's coming in. The more sophisticated they are, the better they are at it. But what's happened over the years is that, I'm going to put this any differently than straight out on the table, is that everything that we've done in retail to improve productivity always came at the cost of service. So every time you introduce new technology that somehow you were saving on a process, well, guess where the hours got cut? Retail. So there's always been a financial impact, right? And it's always been at the front lines. You very seldom saw anyone lose their job or hours reduction at a home office or a distribution center. It was predominantly on the retail front lines. But if you ask me the question differently and say, what would you do? Well, there's some rules here, and I call them the three C's. And one of them is capital. You need to have money set aside that you do training, recruiting, and development on a continual basis. And you need to be able to coach a great deal. That's the second C. And that comes internally by hiring the right management team and providing them with the right training to do that. And then there's the communication top down. You know, what is it that you're trying to strive for by way of a service outcome? What do you want the customer to experience? And you deliver that through additional coaching. You develop programs internally or hire someone externally to develop them for you. But you continuously develop your teams to provide a higher level of service. Now, that's all good. That's well and said. And I can say this because I come from an environment that was a lot of personal touch points with customers. It was the only way you can convert and close a sale and increase a sale. But unless you did that, you weren't going to be successful. For when you start losing businesses, it's because of service, right? Why don't I go back to a certain shop? Because service sucked. You know, why don't I go back to another restaurant? Because service sucked, right? Why don't I go back to the same service station to change my tires? Because I had to wait too long, or they didn't do a good job or fast enough. I mean, that's part of the problem. Why don't you go to the same dentist or optometrist? Because the appointment that you had didn't start for maybe half an hour, 40 minutes after you arrived. And then you had to wait a little longer and it took longer than you expected. You missed another appointment, right? It's all these impacts that a lot of service businesses and retailers misinterpret when they see a customer. They think you have plenty of time on your hands just to flaunt it and just to browse around, but you don't.
Why though, maybe Gary, because you're not one of us, you're one of us, but you come from elsewhere, overseas. By the way, we all love your German accent, Gary. We appreciate it. So, but we're still talking about the sort of US model, this iconic kind of service attitude. And I wonder, part of it may not have nothing to do with retail. Maybe in Canada, we don't grow up thinking about serving people as being something important. I don't know, but I, off camera, we had the example where I say I could show up at a diner anywhere in the US and chances are could be 5 minutes after closing, but they're going to say, yeah, we'll get you a meal. They might make a comment like, hey, we're closed, but we'll do this. But in Canada, they could be closed at 8:30 when the official closing's 9, just because it's a slow night. I've had that happen so much. So is there something even predispositional around Canadians that we have to overcome, or is that me? Am I barking up the wrong tree?
I think it's been a sort of long downward spiral. Maybe I did come to Canada in 97 on my own, and I stayed in the Marriott, and I was overwhelmed by the sheer set of luxury of the service experience. Was brilliant. They couldn't do too much for me. And of course, when I came to live here, I wondered where, you know, was that like a snapshot of something unreal? And when I turned up to the local, you know, hardware store, Canadian Tire, Home Depot, perhaps more Canadian Tire than the American retailers here, it was pretty clear that something had been broken. And I don't know what I could put my finger on at that time, but maybe during this discussion it become more clear. I think that retailers who have a habit of bringing in part-time people because they're under some kind of cost pressure, trying to match the hours with the demand curve, and get a few part-time people, maybe some working mothers can go in here, some school leavers, after-school workers, and some university students, whatever it is. Their motivation at one level isn't anything to do with working for that brand and building that brand. It's just getting the money. And if they can get away with not doing very much, that's even better. It's relatively easy money. Just turn up, get the money, do a few things, look busy, and then go home. It's a bit of a whiz. But I think that coming out from that is a sort of a perfunctionary nature of being in retail, or certainly on the retail floor, is that if you think about one of the criticisms of Amazon, it's as a discovery platform, it's not very good, because you can key in like toothbrush and you get 40,000 results back at you. You think, somebody's got to help me here. So when I go into Canadian Tire, there's no, you know, as a discovery platform, as a brand, as a discovery platform, it's terrible. I know where the tools and hardware is. I know every sort of slot in every store I go to, exactly how it's all laid out, etc. But that's because I go there pretty much every weekend when they're open. But as a somebody wanting to solve a problem and to maybe impulse shop, I just don't think these platforms we have in Canada are very good, and it's enhanced, if I can put it that way, by the low quality of staffing, often in many of the retailers I visit. I think that the two go together, that the store owners, the brand builders, have got no interest in the customers, and the people who go in there have kind of generally not got a long-term future in that brand or even in retail. And so they're just doing it in a perfunctionary manner.
I think that's a great point. And it kind of goes back to what George was saying, like, you know, the training of staff, like the staff aren't bad. It's not, it's just not led to an expectation of what the brand's wanting. And also I think that longevity of career. So, you know, back in the day, you could start as a store, you know, staffer, and you could work your way up to assistant manager and regional manager. And there was like opportunity to grow and learn if you wanted to be a part of that brand. And I just wonder if that little piece of the puzzle is sort of missing because you're not going in and getting training. I mean, Nordstrom's is a great example. They have an incredible training program for buyers, for merchants, and they really take the time and effort, and you go in those stores and, you know, you're really served well, and they connect with you, they reach out to you, they try and get to know you. And we talked about this, I think, at another point too, like, what's the incentive for the retail staff? Do they get a bit of commission, or is there something else that kind of incentivizes them to build their sales during the day? I mean, the Gap, we used to basically every hour in the hour be checking our targets to make sure that we knew where we were, and we were trying to really build to that daily goal that we had. And I just, you know, again, I think it's the cheapening of just get bodies on the floor and not really spend the time to train and educate and have them be the brand advocates. Whereas you go into other stores and they've got brand advocates, and you connect with that, and there's a loyalty to the brand, and these people want to be a part of the brand. They're excited about the brand.
Why in the US, Christine, why in the US, you mentioned Target, that's just an ordinary department store. Why did you say in the US that they do a really good job of service, and you believe it?
Yeah,
why is it different? Like, or is one country offering commissions and the other country isn't? There's something deeper here we got to get to.
Yeah, well, I definitely think the minimum wage in Oregon, at least, is a lot higher than some other states. So that's one thing that kind of plays into it. But then I also think it's sort of the benefits and the discounts and all the other things that the staff get when they're at that's the store. But there's, you know, they're building, you know, number one, they're the Target, it's easy. They're all in a red t-shirt, you know, their staff. They've got people working the floor, putting the inventory out, and then they've got people helping you. There's service kiosks, like if you do self-checkout, there's always one or two people guiding and helping you through that. If you're stuck on the machine, they're coming to help. Every department, there's somebody sort of mulling around, and it's not going to be like high service, like going into like a whole Renfrew, but you still have someone around that you can reach out to. And then they have their little kiosk. So if you can't figure out the price of an item, you can go scan it. But I've never been in a Target lately where I haven't been able to find someone within a few short minutes. And if they can't help me, they're like, I'm going to find someone who can help you. Versus you go into other stores, yeah, like, yeah, sorry, I don't know. I can't help you. But I don't know that it's necessary. Like, I think it's twofold. It's sort of, are these brands training and educating and having these staff understand the expectation of what they should be delivering as an experience to a customer? And if you're not trained to do that and you're not used to selling, you're just kind of plunked on the floor, I think, you know, you're missing out. And the training takes time, the education takes time, like those things take time. And you're building into something that you want, obviously, longevity, and you want to keep these people with you. But you've got to do things that, you know, flexible hours, just everything that you can as a brand to make it enticing for retail staff to come and join your company and to stay with your company and want to, you know, grow with your company.
Exactly. So I've got three examples I can think of where we've had clients we worked with who thought of selling as a dirty word. And this is at the very senior level. These are chains, specialty chains in Canada. And I don't know how common that is for the rest of you, but I can think of them, and they would equate, and this is totally unfair, but they'd often cite Future Shop. They'd say, we don't want our people to be Future Shop salespeople where you feel like you're going to get descended on, you know, and commission driven to the extent that we're going to push something on you. But what they would do is go extreme the other way. And what that does for in both our research, but we've worked at this a long time, what this does for shoppers is the leaving them be makes it a very self-service environment. And as online gets more and more commonplace, that's also self-service, your contrast is minimal. It's just all the, it's like, it's online. If we're not going to get service anyway, we might as well go online because we can see more stuff. But I think the customers themselves are a bit of a problem in that we have this very delicate balance of we want to be acknowledged and we want to have someone there the minute we think we have a question. But, and I think this is more Canadian than American, but don't come in and intrude on my space otherwise. And so it's that really delicate balance of someone, if they're coming in and they're kind of suggesting, jumping to suggestive selling a little too quick, we get very, you know, stay away from me. But again, the minute we think we want something and we don't see a staffer near us, we're not happy either. I think in the States, The consumer is a little bit more comfortable with that salesperson coming up to them because they know the dance. The dance is all about service.
And there's an art to that as well. And the other thing is connecting with a consumer, there's another major reason behind that. It's loss prevention. So if someone's coming in your store, you want to connect with them, you want to make eye contact and know that that person's been acknowledged so that they're not going to like shove off to the sidelines and steal a bunch of your product. And it's the subtle form of, you know, have you been in lately? We've got some new items. If you want to check it out, you know, I'm here. If you need me, let me know. Like, I just think it's like the training piece of it. So there's this fear factor of being like, you know, the slimy car salesman is a bad analogy, but, you know, being all over someone. And then there's also the just like allowing them to shop and not bugging them too much. But I do think you have to have those connection points so they know that you're there if they need them, to your point. So I think, what's that?
It won't change until the culture of the organization changes.
Well, absolutely.
Right. And then when the cultural message is being delivered, then the field teams that are out there recruiting are going to recruit not for staffing, but for service, sales and service. And
that's a great way to frame it.
Yeah.
And right now, and for the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years, I've seen this erode over time, that it's become more about staffing than it has been about service. or any customer experience. And I have to be quite honest with all of you. When I hear anyone who talks about experience, creating an experience, if you're not about to hire a number of talented people who are customer oriented and happy to serve, you haven't got a hope in hell in making that experience come to life.
No,
you just don't. And you're wasting time and effort.
And they have to be brand loyalists. I mean, that's the other key too. Like, if you got staff on the floor and they're not connected to your brand, like, how are they going to sell your brand? So whether that's, you know, they're given the apparel to wear, to try, that they've experienced it themselves, that they can build that sense of community with the people that are coming in. I think, you know, again, a lot of like athleisure brands do that. Like, their staff are wearing the product. They're really used to it. I use Aritzia as a great example. Now, they've got stores down here, but they really connect with the consumer when you walk in the door. They show you what's new. You get in the fitting room. They're really helping you. I mean, there's been many times when I've gone in there and I'd say, you know, I'd never get something, and they open me up to thinking about something I wouldn't have thought of before. So, but it's, you know, again, there's they're brand loyalists. They want to be a part of the brand. They want to share the brand with you and share what they like about it. And they want to help you find something really great so that you can become a brand fan.
Christine, could I just return to George's point about the customer experience? And I think there's a much wider point here. I feel it in Canada. We love concepts, omni-channel, you know, all this kind of stuff, customer experience, a customer journey, store of future. It's all about talking about something rather than doing something. We can mystify ourselves by talking a lot amongst ourselves about whatever it might be, whatever this week's fad is. I just wonder how much energy is poured into these great concepts, maybe in the glossy brochure, or heard recently on the radio, or seen in the commentary, or a consultant they bumped into in a drinking hole. They seem to get obsessed with the thought of this great, you know, competitive advantage that we're going to get if we only can find a way of implementing. Oh, don't worry about implementation, just talk about it, it's fine, we're delivering curbside.
We're by the system, Gary. If we bought the system, then we can check the box, right? It's a product.
There's a big difference between the theory of creating service and customer experience versus actually delivering it, to Gary's point, right? I mean, look, we as executives, even as a junior and mid executive, we used to laugh at anybody that worked in the office and would try and come out with a strategy on customer experience or service, and they haven't spent 1 hour in a store. I mean, that is a joke. You want to understand as an organization how to change what's happening in the stores, get out of your desk, send the marketing and merchandising team down to the stores, not for days, weeks.
Yeah.
Working.
Right. And, there's a lot of great brands that do that.
And go to the best of the best. Go visit those. But again, I always like to get back into the root thing. So one thing I want to just parse out is, I think customer experience incorporates service, but they're not identical. And I also think you can have an operation where the experience is not very rich at all, but it can be very, very deep on service. So they're not one and the same. And the thing about service is, again, going back to that notion of there's value in serving other people, there's an attitudinal thing there. And I think it's harder for a brand. Christine, I agree with you. You know, the brand has to train that. But if you have someone walking in the door to get the job and they don't have an inkling of that to begin with, you've got a lot of work to invest. If you're coming out of some kind of culture or a place where there's a critical mass of retail and food service that exhibits that, so your prior job emphasized that, now you go to the new job, I think it's easy to build on it. And I think the problem in Canada is we have so few really good examples. And there's not a pride in serving. Like, we don't, I don't feel there's inherently that. And then you add on selling. Nobody wants to be called a salesperson, especially in retail, but there's a proud tradition of that. Like, being a really good salesperson is an amazing talent, and it's not push selling at all.
Where I came from, everyone was a sales associate.
There you go. That's right.
That was your life. That was, if you were working for us in retail, you were a sales associate. Yeah. And that spoke to the level of service that you had to provide to be able to close the sale. You don't get a sale just because someone comes into the store. You have to create that sale experience. And they're not going to buy, to Christine's earlier points about walking into a store and being the brand ambassadors and, you know, talking about the brand, talking about the new fashion that's in or the new products or new styles that have come in. All of that is a difference. You're telling the story and people mm-hmm. love to hear about it because they want to be the first to own something that somebody else might not have.
Yeah. And right? it's deep training. It's product knowledge. I mean, working as a waitress at Earl's, product knowledge sessions on, different things that we were serving, or, having distilleries or people coming in and training, or working at Abercrombie and Fitch back in the day, and you'd have like someone come in from a brand and do a product knowledge session with the staff so that they understood. And that gave you the tools to be able to understand what you needed to sell when a customer came in.
Raymond Schulman on our team, just to pick up on that, he has a great story of Nordstrom because at the time he was selling for Boss, right? So he came in with some people. He was a senior exec, but he came in with some people to do a product knowledge session with Nordstrom. And he said the Nordstrom VP was there and noticed two of the Nordstrom sales associates talking while the product knowledge session was going on. So he interrupted, called timeout, apologized on behalf to the boss people on behalf of the Nordstrom staff, and then told the Nordstrom staff that they were going to have to recreate this product knowledge session the next day. And boy, did they get their notepads out. Yeah. But those are the actions, I think, Gary, that you're talking about, right? Like, it's easy to say the stuff, but that exemplifies why at Nordstrom it's important. It's all the way through.
In the United States, yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Well, Craig, what's your thought on Nordstrom as an example, stateside to Canada?
You know, it's interesting because Nordstrom, the narrative is that the retailer has excellent customer service. And I've experienced that in various parts of the United States. But one thing that I found here in Canada is there was a bit of a rush, certainly, to hire people initially. I know a few people, I won't name their names, but they were doing the hiring here when the two Toronto stores were opening, and they opened quite close together, about a month apart. It was tough to find the staff. They hired young people that often were inexperienced, didn't really see retail as a career, which in itself I think is a conversation to have. The downtown CF Toronto Eaton Centre Nordstrom store had an 88% turnover in the first year. I don't know if I can say this, but I will. The manager of the store was let go amid some controversy. A very challenging time. And I'm not trying to bash Nordstrom here, but I had an experience where a young man, was very highly unprofessional. I was, again, in the store. I was in the menswear department, and I made a little bit of a wisecrack. There was a poster that you could see from within the Nordstrom store for Harry Rosen, which also has a store at the CF Toronto Eaton Centre. And I cracked a joke, and the sales guy said, "Oh, they suck. We have better Canali suits. Don't go there." And I'm just like, "Holy shit!
That doesn't sound on goodness Nordstrom brand."
No. And, which is compared to, I was in San Diego a few years ago, and, I was in a Nordstrom store. And so there was a Neiman Marcus store, in the mall. And there was a Nordstrom store and a Bloomingdale's and a couple of others. But I said, "Oh my goodness, Neiman Marcus is closed." I think it was about 8:30 PM. And he says, "Oh yes, be very polite. Our neighbor, closes their store early," very, very, very respectable. You come here to Canada, it's a different experience. I think that, it is hard to find the right staff here. I don't think that retail is seen as a career in Canada the same way as the United States. I think that there is an opportunity to do that. But I've talked to salespeople, say, in great stores like Saks Fifth Avenue in New York City, where they're career salespeople. They make well over $100,000 a year based on commissions. They're highly successful. They're highly trained. They're educated in their product and they know how to sell. We do have people like that in Canada, but I partnered with a luxury staffing agency here in Toronto, and it's really hard to find great people. Basically, everyone's just poaching everybody from everybody else. So, when Nordstrom opened, you're like, "Oh, hey, I know you from Holt Renfrew." And then they left. Same thing with Saks Fifth Avenue. You know, I know you from Holt Renfrew and Nordstrom. It's just, I think it's just incredible. I mean, it seems like there's the same talent pool that's there that's exceptional that everyone's just trying to steal. And then on top of that, you get the mono brands that come in and try to take them because they're like, we need you for Balenciaga or Prada or Gucci. You know, some will demand a book of customers and some won't. So it is very different here, you know, and I'm really quite shocked. So, but, you know, it's sort of just going on, but, you know, so you get a Harry Rosen store, a very, you know, it's high touch service. Some people will not go in there because it's considered to be too high pressure. I'm kind of one of them to a degree. If I pop into a Harry Rosen store and don't want to buy some, well, I'm hesitant to do that because I'm going to be hounded by 12 people trying to sell me something, you know, whereas you go to a Hudson Bay store or a Shoppers Drug Mart, which doesn't even have people at the till anymore. You know, you're getting a pretty much a zero customer service experience. And there's just such a dichotomy there that I'm really disappointed with a lot of what I see in retail from a customer service perspective in Canada.
Well, I think the problem is endemic. Sorry, Gary, you go ahead.
Really interesting to listen to Craig there and just listen the old cogs work. And it's, this is a leadership issue. Clearly, I know what we've kind of alluded to that about what leaders should be doing within the ranks, but actually it's a fundamental leadership. But, you know, the concepts they chase and don't deliver, the sales and expertise on the floor that must be there, the selection of people who must be there, the cultural fit to what we're trying to achieve. We can't look anywhere else but the senior leadership, the C-suite. This is the root cause of why our service in Canada is relatively weak compared to other countries.
So what if there's a chicken and egg issue, though, that at the C-suite you could say, okay, if we're going to navigate this omni world, we need our stores to mean something. So instead of looking for automation where we strip out people, we need to double down on that human element. That'll be our differentiator. But as Craig pointed out, there's a very finite pool of people feeding in, and there's not a sense of, I want to do this for the long haul. Do you feel like you're going to, and maybe George, you could best answer this. You feel like you could theoretically invest a lot of money in the training Christine's called for, and have people be around 6 months to a year, walk out, and there's not the replacement. Like what comes first, a bigger kind of consensus that this kind of career matters to me?
So we're listening to all of you just now. What came to mind right after I heard Craig as well, is that now after COVID, whenever after COVID it comes and the stores are fully open, a lot of people who have been in retail on the service side, the front lines, are probably asking themselves this question, is this a career path anymore?
Yeah.
Right? I'm now vulnerable. Anything happens, it's shut down. I can't make an income. I'm on CERB. I'm on some incentive that I'm getting from the government to survive, which happens to be more and costs me less to go to, because I don't have to go to work. Therefore, when I do have to go to work, I'm going to find a job. And by the way, Amazon advertises that they've created 90,000 jobs in Canada. Think about that.
And a lot more are coming.
So think about that. So why do I have job stability in that environment versus an environment that could get shut down? So now the retailers, going to your point, David, and answering your question, now the retailers have a conundrum. If I'm going to operate stores, I need to find a way to keep people motivated to want to continue to work in that environment, come rain or shine. And what kind of incentives am I going to create? What's the brand story? What's the culture going to look like? I'm going to have to create a culture at the store level that creates that experience that ties back to the omni-channel completely. And if I can't, then I'm in a lot more trouble because the customer is going to say, you know what? I like your products, but I'm not going to waste my time. And I'm not going to waste my time driving to a store and having to fiddle my way around your environment, not get what I want, where I can go online and get it from you there a lot faster. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You do it right, or you pay the price.
Well, and can I add on to that, which is the only way I see being able to pull that off is to create a great employee experience in order to serve the customer experience. And I find that is often lacking.
Yeah, absolutely.
And back to the point, not just the compensation for them, but all of it. How do you get them excited and give them a great... And I think we're at a real crisis for this right now. And especially with more and more head offices disappearing from Canada, when you start to even talk about the notion of a career, where do you go? Like if you do work at a store and you think I could really invest my time into this, but if there isn't somewhere to rise up to, you're going to look elsewhere in technology or whatever it might be.
And I think crisis is a good word, because there are a lot of people who have worked in retail more on the sales floor that are looking at no longer working in that industry. I think we were talking earlier about chefs and restaurants, but this is certainly the case with retailers as well, because a lot of retail employees have the perception that their jobs are disposable and that they're basically just warm bodies on a sales floor, if there are any at all, pointing to say the Hudson Bay Company, where you got a few staff, you know, per floor in a large store. You know, these employees in many cases feel like, you know, they're just underappreciated. And I think, again, you know, to the point of, you know, Gary and talking about leadership, I think it's a huge issue. And I think even just having freedom. I mean, I remember in university, I actually wrote a paper about Nordstrom at the core, of course, because it was eons ago, it was only in the United States. And I think they said the employee handbook was like basically the size of a business card. And it says, you know, use your best judgment in the decisions that you make. Yeah. Well, that's not true. Because when Nordstrom opened in Calgary, I was working with the University of Alberta, living in Edmonton. We, you know, took students down there and we decided to talk to lots of people. We talked to, this was in 2014, just before the oil prices went down. Talked to a young man on the women's floor at Nordstrom, and he said, "Oh, I hate this job. I'm quitting tomorrow." And I said, "Oh my God, what happened? I thought Nordstrom was the greatest place in the world to work." And he said, "Yeah." He said, a woman had asked him for a jacket that was on a mannequin. They had nothing in her size for that style. I think they had one of each size and wanted to take it off the mannequin. But the rule in the store was only a merchandiser could take the jacket off the mannequin. Well, that merchandiser, I think, was on a break or lunch or could not be found. And this employee had been disciplined because he took it off the mannequin to sell to the woman. And at that time, again, with the oil prices being high, you could get a high paying job anywhere. And he's like, "I feel underappreciated. Goodbye, Nordstrom. I'm taking off." And I hear all kinds of stories like this from retail employees, because I talk to a lot of people, not so much with the lockdowns we've had in Ontario recently. That's ending, fortunately. But nevertheless, I think feeling underappreciated, whether or not that's pay or whether or not that's just, you know, being appreciated by, you know, customers in the store, you know, are they screaming at you because you're asking them to put on a face mask, or are they not getting the customer service that they want, or are they unhappy with something else? I think all of these factors come together, and I'd be really curious from an international perspective what retailers are doing that are highly successful and have great customer service. We're not talking about, are you being served? You know, Gary, if you see the show, but which
I saw it the first time. There is a sort of like a little bit of an isolated incident here in an area which we've kind of skated over. Costco opened, I don't know, 5-6 years ago in my town, and they opened for interviews for, like, what do we call it, when you just queue up and put your resume in. I don't know what it's called.
It's a cattle call.
Yeah. So, but they opened from 8 o'clock in the morning to 6 o'clock. And they were recruiting for 600 or 700 people initially. And that 6 o'clock, they still had 200 people queuing up. And I have to say that in all the reports I hear and read, and even when I go and experience Costco, their employees seem settled. Their employees seem engaged.
They are hired. It is very difficult to hire someone away from Costco. Sorry, go on, but I just wanted to confirm that. Again, I have so many insights.
They're incredibly well paid, especially in the US.
Yeah, their compensation, and yeah, I mean, they're treated well. The staff are treated well, and they, you know, again, that's another great example, the service level there for a Costco. There's always someone around. You can always get help. Yeah.
But if they're competing, if we're talking about a crisis where there's going to be a shortage, maybe we need to get our act together and start figuring out how, it's not just the pay, it's the respect. I mean, often pay signifies that, and people need a threshold money, bit of money. But if you're getting paid more, but you're getting treated like crap, you often will move anyway. Yeah. But I think Costco is a great example. So what are you building that signifies to frontline people you value them? And is that self-checkout getting implemented like you mentioned Shoppers Drug Mart, Craig, a program where you're telling the few staff you have in there that they're supposed to be pushing people to self-checkout, doesn't that tell them something?
And it tells the customer something too. That's a whole nother conversation. But I think that what Shoppers Drug Mart is doing is absolutely deplorable. They're been potentially taking jobs away from people. I got in trouble by McDonald's when I said that, when they started implementing these self-checkouts. I went on CBC News and said, oh, they're going to take jobs away. And they actually came to my office at the University of Alberta to lecture me on how this worked. But I think with Shoppers Drug Mart now, I think it's just absolute garbage. I mean, you go into those stores, you know, there's no one there. They basically want you to check out. Then they don't even have hand sanitizer there so that you can, you know, keep up with health protocols. I've started shopping at Rexall because they always have someone at the till.
Before you go on.
There goes any kind of sponsorship we were going to get right there. It was
done. Oh no, Rexall's going to sponsor us, George.
I have to say this: the Shoppers Drug Mart self-service disc, whatever you like to call them, went up around the time of the pandemic was breaking out, when we knew it was 6 feet apart. There's no way that there's three of them in a bank. There's no way that anybody can be 6 feet apart if we're all trying to cash up our thing on the self-service checkout. So I think that alone was a big miss for my local store, my local Shoppers. So I'm assuming that format is adopted wherever they've put these things.
Yeah.
There wasn't a particular space constraint. They could have carried on and made it a bit bigger. I only had two instead of three. So yeah, I think that's a major miss.
Gary, I'm going to say this because what comes to mind is someone once told me, he goes, you know, all these policies and procedures that retailers tend to have that filter down to the retail floor, is that, and so many of them are about loss prevention, managing cash, managing inventory. And they said, look, we're all about sales prevention.
Mm.
And I said, what? And they said, yeah, we're all about sales prevention. He goes, we're too busy doing all these policies and these processes that we don't have enough time to deal with customers. There's a lot of truth to this, and every retailer is about that. But when you go to Shoppers Drug Mart, what I've noticed is that the same person who's running the cash is restocking, right? So I'm thinking, okay, you either have a labor issue or you have a product, you've got productivity challenges that you're trying to manage, and you're not managing the hours appropriately or not filling them in where they should be. But at the end of the day, you know, you've got to do a better job, even if it's just a self-checkout. You got to do a better job managing things than you do today, because that experience sticks with the customer.
George, it's back to priorities. And I'm thinking of, say, Trader Joe's in the States. You can tell, you if you go there a few times, you can feel that every single staff person there is there to make sure that you have a good shopping experience. Doesn't matter what they're doing. They eyes on a swivel looking around, where can they be of service? And, you know, Craig, we've sort of talked about this. We have a unionized environment in Canada for grocery, and I don't want to crap on that aspect, but I think what happens is you end up... I'll let you do that. What I'll say is... because I can go a little lefty also and say what probably the Trader Joe's people are treated quite well also. So they probably wouldn't want a union there. But the idea of being fixated on my start time, the punch the clock, like valuing yourself by when you start and end a shift and what your tasks are, is kind of the antithesis of being service minded. And I just remember being at a Trader Joe's where as soon as someone saw a line start to form, there's a bell, and it's in all the Trader Joe's, but they start clanging the bell, and I'm going, what's the first time I heard it? What's that? And someone's yelling out, hey, we can help you over here. And they just open up another line, and it's all fun. Like, they do it with a smile, right? It's fun. Like, it's almost gamified.
Well, and they basically all do everything. So there's not really a hierarchy. It's like... Yeah. You work the cash wrap, you work restocking, you work helping customers. Every single time I go in there, if I can't find something, they physically walk with me to the space and show me where it is. They don't say, oh, it's over there around the corner. It's like, here, I'll show you. And they take you there. I've never had any issues. If there's something, the quality's not right, they'll take a return back. No problem. I mean, they're really known for incredible customer service. Everyone's happy in there. they have a lot of fun together, and it shows, because the people, the customers coming in, it's fun for us. You know, even with COVID, they had all these fun little signs and they had us lined up, and, you know, people were cracking jokes. They had one guy who was like singing. He was like a singer that worked part-time at the Trader Joe's, and he was standing outside singing to us while we're waiting in line. And
isn't it's just, awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it just, they allow them to kind of be themselves, and it's, you know, a little bit of the flourish, and everyone's got a little different vibe going on. But every single staff in there, I mean, I've seen the one that I go to regularly, they all work in every department and they all are super helpful. They're happy. They help each other. Like, it's just really collaborative.
Wow. This is so different from Dollarama. I was in a Dollarama store a couple of years ago before the lockdown, and I couldn't believe it. They had two people to check out because they really don't have many people in the actual store helping you. I guess poor people don't deserve customer service, because these two people, you know, when I was in the store, I'm not poor. They were talking to each other the whole time, didn't even make eye contact, rang the purchases through, and I left. And I actually said, holy F, I won't say the word, as I left. I could not believe how disgusting, I think I used that word twice here already, that customer service or lack of customer service was. It was just, it makes you not want to go back, but I guess, you know, you can go to a Harry Rosen or Holt Renfrew and get some good customer service. Apparently if you're poor and you go to Dollarama, you don't, but it's just incredible that, you know, again, these people were probably just there to collect their wage, had no training beyond how to use a cash register. And that's
probably
it.
Thought
and,
they were doing their job right. Right.
Yeah.
It was horrible.
Want to do a bad job. That's most people don't want to show up and do a crappy job. They don't, but if they don't know.
But that's why consumers have left stores, not entirely. Like, I hear a lot of people, you know, I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna kill it this way. You know, I hear a lot of people who have conceded themselves into believing they're experts on retail and have never worked a day in a store. But at the end of the day, you know, they're trying to tell me that stores are still there. I agree, stores will still be there in the future. But the problem is that if service sucks, I'm gonna buy online.
Yep.
Why am I, you think I'm going to inconvenience myself? It's not going to happen. But I will tell you a very strange story about having to buy a 14-year-old a suit. And I hauled him down there. We went to the men's store because he was getting taller. We bought him a suit for an event. But while we're in the store, they're playing this loud music. Mm-hmm. And the sales associate comes over dancing. I thought, well, this is strange, right? He goes, well, and then I'm trying to hear him, listen to him talk. I can't. He's speaking too shallow. The music's too loud. Right. My wife is with me. And I said, can you hear him? She goes, no, I can't hear him. I said, you know what? Can you turn the music down? I can't hear you. He goes, oh no, we can't do that. It's part of our training. But part of your training. He goes, yes. The manager comes over. Yeah, it's hilarious. Manager comes over to tell him he's not moving to the music enough.
Can you tell us what store this is? Because I'd like to not ever go there. Okay.
It was a men's chain.
Holy, in Canada.
Yes, in Canada. Here's the point, though. I mean, it was, I don't know whose idea this was, right? But it was so flawed that I was flabbergasted. We didn't buy the suit. We left, right? Because I couldn't hear. My 14-year-old looking at me, I don't want to be here.
So can I give you the upside of all this? This is like the hope on the horizon for independent retail. Christine even made the point right off the top. Of was it made in Oregon?
Made your PDX, yeah.
Made your PDX. I had an experience at a garden center, really small one with interesting plants, and every single staffer was trading off with each other, and just going up to people if they're looking at a plant, just giving them a little info on it. It didn't even have to be a "Do you want to buy it?" It was like a "Did you know?"
Yeah.
Or have you ever grown one of those before? And then it engages. And we ended up buying twice as much as we went in to get, and coming out feeling really good about that. That was so unusual, but it's the, you know, it's not every independent I'm going to glorify, but those are where maybe this stuff kind of goes on, where they have a fighting chance.
Yeah.
Especially if they're very specialized like that. And they've got people who are passionate, as you said, Christine, about the product category of the brand, but the owners obviously said, here's how we want this to work.
Yeah. Yeah, the expectation is set around what your, you know, your role is in the company, and what your expectation is for how you are greeting customers and what you're doing and how you're selling. And I mean, it takes time to feel comfortable selling. And it's not something that comes easily to a lot of people, but a lot of it's relationship building, and it's the community, and it's the connection. And it might be a customer coming in the first time, you're like, hey, this is something new, and a little snippet about something. And then the next time the conversation goes further and further, and then eventually they become kind of loyalists to the brand. But it's building a relationship. It's not, you know, it doesn't necessarily always happen super quickly.
I love that term, relationship. And I think that's, I think we've got to get back to that. Everyone's in these micro moments of selling. And I'm going to say that's one of the knocks I have on the digital side of things. I think there's so much good coming out of it, but it sort of dehumanized the process, not only the lack of a human service, but it kind of turns people behind the scenes into bits and bytes, right? It's data points. And I've got clients where they forget the, you know, trying to go in and say, well, who is the customer? The techie analysts don't really care. Like, they don't care who it is. They just care that the little blips are going on and there's someone's abandoning a cart. But I want to know more about that. Like, everyone in that company should feel an empathy for those people. And I think that is sort of one of the things I've really noticed with the online plays is when everything goes super smoothly, it absolutely bests a poorly served physical store. But whenever you've got a problem, that'll always happen, right? There's outliers. Try getting a human being to solve something. And I find a lot of software service companies are like that, where you need to get a question answered and it needs to be a conversation, and they keep pointing you to the FAQs. And it's so freaking frustrating.
Well, so I think it's going to change.
It's got to change. And you're seeing more chat options forming, right? Like that whole chat thing is maturing in a really good way online, but it's got to be personable. It's got to be listening and reacting. And
it will be, because I was talking to the owner of Rudsack and a few other retailers. What they're finding now is, they're able to use artificial intelligence for people to ask simple questions to have answered. About 60% of the questions asked online now that are simple are able to be answered through artificial intelligence chatbots. But now what they're doing is they're bringing in associates and even stylists online to give one-on-one customer service with customers. And they've implemented a lot of this already. They found so much success that they've determined that they're going to cut their store count by about a half, and that 50% of their sales are going online because they're able to offer a really great customer service experience online. And this isn't something that I thought, I've been studying this for a while, could be done. So they're actually creating a better customer service experience than you're getting in a lot of brick and mortar stores, and you're not even in a brick and mortar store.
And how freaking ironic is that, right? That, hey, we can't achieve this in a store with human to human visual contact, but we can create the same thing somewhere else. I think that's amazing. We've got business leaders in Canada in particular have some really tough things they've got to work through for themselves right now and decide where they're going with this.
And the window for that is really small.
Really tight. And there's people moving into other careers. The whole career in retail is an issue. I'll also say, though, food service, you still need that. And to give some kudos, I think people, Christine mentioned Earls. I think Earls, there's a number of them that are out. Cactus, a lot of them are actually in Vancouver headquartered, but they're outstanding at that teamwork service level. Mm-hmm. There are good stories out there.
But there is a woman in Vancouver that has a restaurant where you're served by a robot. Is this going to be the future as well? Like, apparently this robot is very polite and doesn't drop things. And, it cost her about $10,000 to buy from China. And this robot will bring you your food. Apparently for COVID, this was desirable because you're not going to ever get sick from a robot. I don't think they can carry COVID as far as I'm aware. The automation of retail at the same time, I think, is a challenge, concern, and opportunity all into one.
And the key for me, though, is if you're a leader and you're thinking automation as a panacea, remember every customer that has an outlier moment and you're leaving them high and dry, it's not like it's all going to be like 1% of us. It's going to be all of us during the course of a week have those moments. So you need to figure that out. You can't just sort of slap on the tech and hope that you've solved it.
But you're not going to have, the future of customer experience, it's going to be tech driven.
It's got to be
at the retail, at the front line, it's going to be tech driven. There's no other way to make that happen, in a very efficient and effective way and a consistent way, right? Because the customers are going to expect that. And unless you have the right people there over and over again, I don't know how you do it.
Let's get Gary the last word here, because
I just want to pause George's comment on that, because I think that me and him would agree, because we're making an assumption everybody else understands what George has just said, that we need to understand what we're trying to achieve and then get the tech to sit on top of that. So we design the process and put the tech on it. And I think too many people go careering down a road which says, just get me the tech. Perfect. And we always have to step back and think, what are we trying to achieve? How are we going to do it? And how can tech help us to get there faster?
And if it's about us selling more stuff, be honest with yourself that that's what you're pushing out, as opposed to saying we're customer centric, because that's not customer centric. Customer centric is listening, looking at, and trying to solve repeatedly on an ongoing basis customer challenges and friction points.
But over the last 10 years, there's been a lot of technology that has been developed for the change room, you know. Everything has been provided, created, never gone anywhere. It's never.
I got a great. So Land's End in about 2000 was at every conference. If you remember Land's End Outfitters, they're at every conference because they did the first virtual mirror, like where you could kind of play around with the mirror in the change room. So they were getting all these accolades written up, and we went in to do some work with them. You know, a little over a decade later, and we just brought it up and we go, yeah, and you guys were the first. They go, don't talk about that here. We blew so much money. It was a total unmitigated disaster. And people got fired over it because it didn't really work. It was flashy, and so it got a lot of conference notoriety, but
including this, by the way, you know, I've gone to stores where they put charging stations in. That was the whole panacea. They're still in those stores empty. Nobody puts their phone in them. Probably afraid of being stolen. But
David, you did, and you didn't remember your password because you were too intoxicated at the Nordstrom opening in Toronto. But then we learned they have facial recognition technology. But we weren't supposed to tell anybody about that.
It was so good that they could spot drunk Dave versus sober Dave. So they knew.
Well, one thing I noticed.
That was a good opening party, by the way, Craig. I've got photos from that.
Yeah, I've been to.
So to see, apparently.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I didn't get any photos of you overly intoxicated. Well, maybe a couple overly intoxicated. But one thing I found with Aldo, which is interesting, because again, I've done a lot of writing. I did something for Canadian Retailer when it was a magazine with Retail Council of Canada. It's now defunct. But what Aldo was doing in terms of technology was they were empowering their employees as well as creating a better customer service experience. So the employees had access to know everything that was available in, say, the storage room downstairs. We went to the Yorkdale store to do a tour. But if you think about your traditional shoe store experience in years past, you'd be with the person that was fitting you with the shoes, if that exists. That doesn't exist so much anymore, but it did. But they'd go to the back room and get you the shoes. Well, Aldo was like, well, no, we want this face-to-face interaction. We don't want to interrupt that customer service experience. So now they have someone expediting the product to come to the salesperson and the consumer that are still together. So the salesperson isn't going to get the stuff now. They've got someone bringing it to them, and they're, you know, integrating the store with the technology. You know, they know what's there. They know what size. They can get it up, and they can do this very, very fast. And things like other innovations like that are using technology to enhance the customer service experience, I think, are great. But you don't want just technology for the sake of technology, because you need an end game and you need a purpose. And you know, to make that investment, you've got to have a reason, and it's got to be to make sales. And I think with that, drive brand loyalty and everything else that retailers should be doing, and in many cases are not.
And you need everyone in the organization, because everyone serves another. Mm-hmm. You need to create that attitude that the tech guys are serving someone else. They're not just pushing technology. But if they understand who that end customer is and really, really understand them as human beings, And you have everyone on the same page, I think that's a prerequisite to getting there. It's not the only way to get there, but I think if you don't have that, then all you're doing are tasks and you're hoping they all end up in a good place.
We should probably do a wrap up around the room and then head on home.
I'd like to hear head on home. I like that's the, like, out the door and then into the living room.
Yeah, into the kitchen.
Gary, want to wrap us up?
Yeah, I think there's still great hope for retailers in Canada. I think that they need to really, really change their paradigm. Everything they've known that they thought was okay in terms of this really relatively low level of customer service, customer engagement, that all has to change. And they need to find the skills in themselves to be bold about what they're trying to achieve in the marketplace, and then go out and get those people to help them to do that. And sometimes it can be external consultants can work with them. And sometimes it's actually getting involved with the sales staff recruitment yeah. process and onboarding process to say, if I'm the CEO of an organization, but I go to a particular store because I know somebody's joining us today. Imagine the power of that on that individual.
Chip Wilson created a culture and it lasted today. It's not about the yoga wear so much. It's the fact that those stores were so empowered. At that point in time, I'd never seen store level staff have so much freedom in a chain. But you can see what good it does. They all feel like they're owners then, right? Yeah. They're not just doing what they're told. They actually could create and shape their work environment and the success that they were trying to go after. I think that got lost. And I think I don't want to blame accountants. Craig wants to blame lawyers. But I think that's part of it. It's shifted to where the accountant is more prominent because of the economic stuff we've been going through for 10 years.
Yeah, but that's all about that. I've talked about it before in early editions, is that product retail concept lifecycle, where many organizations are actually in that decline and they're fast approaching the X-axis. And the way that they keep afloat is chop, 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 get rid of inventory, you know, don't have so much around, cut the sales floor, get cheaper leases, buy cheaper staff, to kind of rather than either transform or reinvent, which is obviously a lot harder work. But these are the tasks ahead of many retailers. You have to get with the plan. You have to do a much better job. And if you do, you'll win.
Yeah, you know what? At the end of the day, I think we should have a round table with all the retail CEOs in Canada and give them our rendition of what we believe service experience should be going forward in the next 20 years. I'm being serious about it.
Oh, I think you are being serious because I think it gets forgotten.
It does. And if you quickly forget about what business you're in. And you know what? My final comment is there are a lot of people who are in regionals, VPs, operations people who are losing their jobs because of the changing environment out there. Careers are ending because of what's happening out there. And you know, they're going to step back in their careers or whatever. So we need to start rethinking retail beyond just e-commerce. We need to rethink retail on the physical side. Just saying stores are going to continue to exist is not enough anymore. You need to rethink the concept and you need to include technology in it. And I don't believe anyone has really gone that far yet.
I agree. And I think it's human beings, and it's, if you're going to be service, if service is going to be your differentiator, and maybe it isn't for everyone, a lot of self-serve models work well, but if it is, then you got to double down on it. You have to invest in that, or you're going to get thrown under anyway. And I think Craig and Christine both made good points in that regard.
And I think with the digital revolution that we're seeing here right now, we're seeing rapid delivery. We're seeing an ease of being able to buy something online. Unless a brick and mortar store or business in general serves a purpose for the consumer to go into it, whether or not that's a great experience or a beautiful environment or convenience, I don't see why a consumer wouldn't just shop online at this point. Because I speak to a lot of retailers. I won't name any here because it would be rather depressing, but a lot of retailers right now are not keeping up with the type of overall, I guess, service and convenience and everything else that we're seeing with technology, where in many respects, there's really no need to go into a store anymore. And this is actually, I think, a scary time for some retailers because they're not just competing against other retailers, they're competing with the experience we get through Apple and the ease of purchase that we get through Amazon. And the consumer is changing so much faster than retailers for the most part, that many retailers are going to get left behind. And I think in the future, some of these digitally native brands that are actually have their finger on the pulse are going to be successful. And I think we're going to see mass casualties in the retail industry just in the next few years from brands that are not able to keep up with what consumers are starting to expect. And we're getting really, really demanding if you think about it.
Absolutely. We've never been so, and we've been empowered to be demanding. Like, we've been told we're king, and that's a bit sexist, actually. How come we're told we're kings? But that's another topic. But we have been told that. And I think if anything with the pandemic, it's bought these guys some time and space, because we've had to like calm down our expectations for a bit. But I think we should be agnostic on the form. In other words, whether it's online or physical, if service is going to be your competitive advantage, then you have to make sure it's not just a word and that you've embedded it right through the organization and people understand why they're serving and be passionate about it. And that could be online with you know, chat. It could be in store with assisted tech. But there's a philosophy and an attitude around serving. And you can't just use the word. It doesn't necessarily translate.
Yeah. Great conversation, you guys.
Great.
Craig, do you want to do a quick, we could edit, but do you want to do the wrap?
You betcha. That was a really good discussion today, everyone. It was got almost a little bit heated, mainly because of myself. No, but I think this is a really, really interesting conversation. I think it's incredibly topical. This is something that I think is incredibly important to the future of retail generally. We probably should be sending this podcast off to all the retail CEOs, as George was saying. If we can't sit around them at a table, at least we can send this off. So this is our conclusion here for the Business of Retail podcast. I want to thank you, everyone here, the panelists today. We've got in the order that they're on my screen, we've got David Ian Gray, Christine Cowan, George Manikakis, Gary Newbery, and I'm Craig Patterson. If you can find us on your favorite podcast platform, we're on YouTube. We're also at thebusinessofretail.ca, that being a website. And thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. And tune in again for more segments of the Business of Retail podcast. Thank you, everyone.
You have been listening to the Business of Retail podcast, an unflinching strategic alternative to the conventional industry discourse. Thank you for joining us. For more information, please go to www.thebusinessofretail.ca.